What does being filled with the Spirit mean? Does it mean that I'm going to have some kind of miraculous gift from God that I can do special things? Does it mean that I will have a victorious Christian life and not really struggle with the sin that's always kind of befuddled me and left me in irons? Does it mean that God will enlighten my heart such that the truth will set me free?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
You know, Jack, we've been taping for about 3 years, and here we are, really going into the last series, probably, of our whole radio program.
Our whole radio career.
Our whole radio career. You might be right. And at least for Christianity at Work. And you and I were talking about, gosh, what do we want to do? And we thought it would be great to look at the book of Acts. And really do an overview of some of the important themes in the book of Acts. Sometimes Acts can be a very controversial book, and people have a lot of different ideas of what it's saying. So we'll pick out not all, but some of the themes, and go with it.
Great.
And I think what's especially great is that what people don't know is that you've been studying it, I don't know, for how long?
A couple years now, yeah.
Specifically to teach it in your church.
Mm-hmm.
So you're fresh, and I think you have some rather interesting perspective on things that were certainly different for me than I've understood in the past. So any general thing to say about it before we dig in?
Well, it's been eye-opening for me. All kinds of pieces have fallen together that I didn't know that they hadn't fallen together, but until I kind of had to understand how to understand these sermons and these messages and the strategies of the apostles and how Luke was constructing his book, as I began to explore some of those ideas, I've learned all kinds of new things. Particularly, I suppose, and we'll talk about some of these things, but the relationship between, let me put it this way, the Jewishness of the gospel, because in the early part of Acts, the message of the gospel is very Jewish. I mean, it's to the Jews. So how do we reconcile that today, we Gentiles who are, it's just not a part of our life and culture and our expectations, how do we fit into that? That's an important thing that we need to understand in Acts. A second thing is, it's helped me, I still don't have total confidence in my view of the prophetic picture, the view of the future, but there are certain pieces of Acts that have helped me, I think, get a better grasp of what the prophets say the future is going to look like. So that's something that we can look at. And then primarily spirituality. Maybe that's the first thing we can talk about today, but it's really refined my understanding of spirituality and the role of the Spirit, what the Spirit is, who the Spirit is. All that has been very helpful.
And that is a very contemporary theme. In fact, I was just talking to a friend who does a lot of work with college students and works with actually Mackenzie Study Center. And she said that one of the things she really sees very much creeping into everywhere is what is spirituality? And I know we did a whole series on that, but I just think it's such a relevant subject. Just kind of going back to what you said a few sentences ago, you didn't know what you didn't know. And mm-hmm. When you started studying the book of Acts, it sounds like from your teaching that I've heard that you're pretty excited
mm-hmm.
about what you've learned. And you've answered some questions, or at least started to answer some questions that you didn't even know to ask before.
Right, that's right.
And so we're going to get the benefit of that new, fresh information.
I hope so, yeah.
Okay, so specifically, let's talk about the spirit today.
Okay.
And the question that I had started with in this subject was, what does being filled with the spirit mean? And yet, just now you said you want to talk about spirituality and the spirit. Is there a difference between those things?
Well, there can be. It seems to me that there's really two different meanings that we could give to spiritual, or even more than two different meanings you can give to spirituality, and so it depends on which particular definition of the word we're talking about. But from the standpoint of the Bible, there is the work of the Spirit in human existence, and then there's everything else. And the really most helpful view of spirituality, or the most helpful definition of spirituality that we can apply, is having to do with the Spirit of God at work in our life. That spirituality is the result of the Spirit of God at work in an individual's existence. Now, what does that mean is another, or what are those results is another question. But just in general, to have it be, to think in terms of what does the Spirit of God produce in my life? That's spirituality, I think. So being filled with the Spirit is really no different than being a spiritual person by that definition, seeing the results, the fruit of that Spirit in my existence.
Okay, great. That's very clear. Now, growing up from high school on, they talked a lot about being filled with the Spirit. And I'm not sure I ever exactly knew what that meant at all. And it seems like it had a lot of different definitions. One of them, which was pretty prevalent, was being filled with the Spirit meant that I had kind of some special powers, some special things I could do, like speak in tongues. And later, being filled with the Spirit, I think, was more defined as you're kind of more Christ-like, more holy, you're kind of maturing. And one thing is very tangible, being able to speak in tongues. The other was very intangible to me, and I think it can be taken in a lot of different ways.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good summary. There might be other options, but those are the only two that come to my mind, is that there's the charismatic version and the non-charismatic version of being filled with the Spirit. The one has to do with having some kind of special infusion of power, and I think the key term is power, to be empowered by the Spirit to speak in tongues, prophesy, gain special revelation, you know, whatever, but be able to do something particularly supernatural, have the power to do something supernatural. That's the sort of charismatic version of being filled with the Spirit. The non-charismatic version tends to emphasize the power again, but the power to have victory over sin, as you put it, to be Christ-like. I have this infusion of power that enables me in an extraordinary way to be obedient and to be kind and to be loving and be Christ-like in every way.
To be a victorious Christian, to
have
the victorious Christian life is the way. I don't know if that's the language they use as much now, but that was certainly the language back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I can't think of any other way that people have construed that, though it seems to fall into one of those two categories.
And of course you have a third.
Yeah, because what those two have in common is that it sees the Spirit as primarily a conduit of power. Actually, my view would differ in two respects. One, what it is that the Spirit imparts, and secondly, whether the way in which the Spirit imparts it is through a kind of ongoing, continuing relationship or through punctuated moments. I think I was inclined to see it in kind of punctuation marks in our life, moments, punctiliar moments in my life where I'd be walking along and I'd be filled with the Spirit. And for the next 30 minutes, maybe I'd be filled with the Spirit. And then my flesh would, the way the theology that I was working with, my flesh would creep back in and I'd be out of the Spirit again. So I would be, almost like some electronic equipment. The switch would be on, and I'd be empowered, but then, lo and behold, somehow the switch would get flipped off, and I'd no longer be empowered in the same way that I had been before by the Spirit.
And I'd have to recognize that and then go flip the switch again.
Exactly, find whatever means.
And I don't know if your experience was this way or not, but it seemed to me that I would know that I had flipped the switch, and I was being filled with the Spirit by how I felt.
Yes.
That was what they told me was kind of an indicator, which I think is really, really misleading. I mean, it is clearly misleading, is
right.
my understanding now.
Right.
But that certainly felt right to me, that if I was being filled with the Spirit, then I'd feel good, I'd feel high, I'd feel close to God. And when I wasn't filled with the Spirit, I wouldn't feel good, I wouldn't feel high, I wouldn't... And also, it's kind of what I did. If I was filled with the Spirit, with that power, I'd want to read the Bible, I'd want to pray, mm-hmm. I'd want to go to church. Those things would be just a part of my want in life, because that switch had been flipped and I was filled at that period of time in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So it's consistent with a theology that sees me being the one who's manning the switch. That is, to the extent that I allow myself to be filled by the Spirit, He will fill me. To the extent that I somehow resist that and do not allow the Spirit to fill me, I won't be filled. So I'm manning the switch, and I'm determining whether I'm filled with the Spirit or not.
And of course, the goal was to always man the switch and have it on.
Exactly. Yeah. And the more I could do that, the faster I would grow. The more accelerated would be my sanctification. The deeper would my sanctification go, and all that was sort of implicitly promised for those who walked according to the Spirit.
And the more I could turn it on, the closer to God I was.
Exactly.
It kind of showed how close to God I was. So I was pretty invested in pretty much always feeling good and doing these things that looked like, said to me, I'm being filled with the Spirit, wanting to read my Bible, wanting to pray.
Right. Exactly. So actually, I think we've put our finger on a third difference that I would have, and that is, I don't see the Bible as ever teaching that we man the switch on the Spirit. Or man the switch on my relationship to the Spirit. I'm not the one who determines whether I'm filled by the Spirit. God is the one who determines whether I'm filled by the Spirit. A radical difference, and a very important difference.
Okay, but I've only heard two, or at least I lost one. One is the power issue that...
And I want to come back to that. I don't think power is the primary issue with the Spirit.
Okay.
The second one is, are we in and out of being filled with the Spirit? Or is discipleship with Jesus a ongoing, continuing process of being filled with the Spirit?
Okay, so power, the off-on switch, and...
And who's manning the switch? If there is a switch, who's manning the switch? So I think we can leave that one alone. We can talk about that, but that would open up a whole can of worms. But it's important to recognize that I think, as we see in the book of Acts, as we see in the Gospels, in Jesus' promise about the coming of the Spirit, that he's not thinking of this in terms of some resource made available to us if we want it, if we will but use it, if we will just avail ourselves of it. He's talking about what God is going to do in the world. And God is not asking anybody's permission about what he's going to do in the world. He's going to send his Spirit, and here's what's going to happen when his Spirit comes. That's the whole spirit behind Jesus' comments on the Spirit in the Gospel of John, and as we go through the book of Acts, that's the perspective the apostles are taking on it, is the Spirit of God is God reaching into history and into the lives of individual Christians to do his will, and to do what he's going to do, and to do what he wants to do, and to shape history the way he wants to shape it. And he doesn't for a second, none of them for a second, imply that, of course, he could never get it done without your cooperation. You know, so by all means, yield to the Spirit. Because otherwise you're tying the hands of God. That's not where they're coming from.
You never hear throughout the whole Bible you can tie the hands up of God. Is that what you're saying?
You do have things like statements like don't quench the Spirit. You do have things like, you know, exhortations to walk according to the Spirit. So there is language that we could construe to mean that is, if you have the lenses on, that I am manning the switch, then those phrases sound like what it's saying is, make sure you turn the switch on. But we could look at each and every one of those phrases. I don't think any of them mean that. That's not what the apostles mean by that. And the overall picture, the overall concept of the Spirit's relationship to us, I would argue quite clearly, is the apostles sitting back and saying, okay, now what is God doing here in history? Oh, he's poured out his Spirit. What does it mean to pour out his Spirit? God is doing his thing now. Whereas he had withheld accomplishing his purposes, he's decided at this point in time, Pentecost, for example, he's decided at the point of Pentecost now, he's going to get on with this phase of his project in human history, and he's just going to do that. Well, he's not pouring out his Spirit to people who are saying, no, I don't want this to happen. I don't want your spirit. And God's going, oh, shucks. What am I going to do now? When he pours out his spirit, it happens. What he sends his spirit to do gets accomplished. And it's not a kind of two-way cooperative effort with mankind. It's a one-way effort of God entering into history to shape it the way he wants to. That's my point.
And you're right. That's a whole can of worms behind that. I think we have some tapes about that can of worms somewhere. But I don't think we should go there today. I do think that we need to talk about what is being filled with the Spirit.
Okay.
We talked about what it wasn't. But, Jack, I would like to come back. And I'm not sure how to structure this, but I would like to come back to those places in Scripture where it does sound like we can tie the hands of God.
Okay.
Like, don't quench the Spirit.
Okay. Yeah,
so
let's do that.
Should we go there now or should we?
Not yet, because I think we need to
define it
deal
first.
With the first issue first. What is the Spirit doing in the world primarily?
And that would flow into, so what then is being filled with the Spirit?
Right.
Okay.
What does it mean to be filled with the Spirit? What would it mean to quench the Spirit? What would it mean to walk according to the Spirit? And
Great. That
kind of thing.
Okay.
What was most revealing to me was actually not in Acts, but Acts took me back to the teaching by Jesus in the book of John primarily, where he is talking to his chosen apostles. And let's look at some of those passages. In chapter 14, for example, well, I'll start here. Philip, this is in verse 8 of chapter 14. Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough for us. Jesus said to him, have I been so long with you, and yet you have not come to know me, Philip? He who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you I do not speak on my own initiative, but the Father abiding in me does his works. Believe me that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. Otherwise, believe because of the works themselves. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who believes in me, the works that I do, he will do also. And greater works than these he will do, because I go to the Father. Whatever you ask in my name, that will I do, so that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask me anything in my name, I will do it. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. I will ask the Father, and he will give you another helper, or the word is parakletos in Greek, will give you another parakletos, that he may be with you forever. That is, the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it does not see him or know him. But you know him, because he abides with you and will be in you. I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you. After a little while, the world will no longer see me, but you will see me. Because I live, you will live also. In that day, you will know that I am in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. He who has my commandments and keeps them is the one who loves me, and he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and will disclose myself to him. What really stood out to me in that passage, there's a whole lot in there we could talk about that's chock full of all kinds of profound statements and problematic statements and provocative statements and controversial statements. But what stands out to me is, I will ask the Father and he will give you another parakletos, that he may be with you forever. That is the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive. I took a look at this concept of parakletos. I have yet to do the kind of thorough word study I want to do. I just haven't had the time to get to it. I want to find some more evidence of this. But the word parakletos, oftentimes in English translations, they will translate it advocate. For example, in 1 John, he says, he opens chapter 2, my little children, I am writing these things to you so that you may not sin. And if anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. That word they translate advocate there in 1 John 2:1 is parakletos, the same word that's used here in John 14. And the reason it's translated advocate is because a common use of it is, as best I can tell, and this is where I'd like to do my own word study. I'm just basing this on lexicons at this point. But as best I can tell, one of the primary uses of it is whenever somebody hired someone to go into a law court. I mean, it's basically our attorney or our lawyer, that if you needed to go to a court trial for some reason or before a judge for some reason, and you didn't speak too good, and you didn't think that you'd be able to represent yourself all that well, you would hire an advocate who was trained in rhetoric probably and was skilled at making arguments and persuading people and compelling people. You would hire them to come in and make your case on your behalf. Or if you were an aqueduct builder and you thought it would be really great to get the contract to build the aqueduct to this new city, you'd go to the Senate, and if you didn't speak too good, then you'd hire an advocate who would come in and make your case to the Senate. And so there was a whole occupation, there was a whole profession that spoke for people, you know, persuaded other people on your behalf for whatever they were. And I don't think it's the only term that's used to describe that group of people, but one of the terms that seems to be used to describe that group of people is parakletos. They were a parakletos.
They kind of became your words, your mouth.
Exactly, yeah, your argument maker. You know, politicians have speechwriters. They were the speechwriters of that day, essentially, writing the speech that you needed said on the particular occasion. So notice that my translation here in John translated it helper. Well, is a parakletos a helper? Yes, it's a helper, but it's a really particular kind of helper. It's not a helper in terms of, you know, domestic help or a housekeeper or a house cleaner or something. It's not help in that sense. It's not a laborer. It's not a helper in the sense of even giving me emotional support, which is, I think, how often this is taken, is that in my time of need, in my time of distress, in my time of trouble, the Spirit is there to help me cope, to help me be emotionally resilient. And oftentimes this is translated comforter in some translations, I guess for that same reason. But, you know, frankly, I'm not really sure. Well, no, that's not true. I know where they get that. Because there is a use of the verb parakaleo that probably does mean something more like that may in some context mean to offer some kind of consolation. But even there, I think the verb means to persuade. It's to persuade the person of what they need to be persuaded of, that they might be consoled, I think is the idea. It's not just the person who comes along and feels with me and empathizes with me and offers that kind of emotional support, which is how I have always taken this in the past, when people said the Holy Spirit is the comforter. Oh, wonderful. And that means anytime I'm emotionally distraught or upset, I have that invisible friend who will come and comfort me and console me and give me what I need to be happy instead of sad. And, you know, as much as that would be wonderful, I don't think that's what Jesus is promising. He's not saying there's this supernatural consoler who's there and available for me whenever I need it and whenever I want it.
This might not be very, very, we kind of have a Prozac culture.
Yeah.
And Jesus is not saying, I'm sending the Spirit as Prozac for you to feel better.
Exactly.
And that's a really important thing for us to know, because if we have that expectation, then it looks like God has really let us down, because most of us in our lives, many of us, do not have easy lives. And when we ask Jesus for that kind of comfort, which is taking us away from the emotional difficulty or the suffering of life, lots of times we don't experience it. And we, again, think, wow, where is God? Where did he let me down? So making this distinction, I think, is incredibly important.
Yeah, and it was really eye-opening to me, because I had just taken it for granted. Yeah, the Spirit's the comforter. Not all of them, but the translations I was familiar with said so, and that's what he's supposed to be.
Okay, so we're at the edge of our seats. So in what way, what does this mean?
Then the other thing to notice is, so this is someone that would be hired by somebody else to persuade somebody of your case, make your case for you. Okay, so what does that mean with respect to the helper? We'll come back to that. The other thing I noticed is, I will ask the Father and he will give you another helper, that he may be with you forever. What does that mean, another helper? Because I had always thought the Spirit was the helper, the one and only helper, the unique helper. Nobody else is the helper. The Spirit's the parakletos. But Jesus is saying he will send you another parakletos. Well, who is the first one? And then it dawned on me, Jesus was the first one. That's what he's saying. Because the whole section is, notice in one verse later, I will not leave you as orphans. I will come to you. The point that he's making is, I'm no longer going to be bodily present. I'm about to leave and be absent from you. In being absent from you, is the role that I'm playing in your midst right now going to go away? Are you not going to have me to play that role in your life anymore? No, because the Father is going to send another Parakletos to you, the Spirit of Truth. And he will play in your midst the same role that I am currently doing in flesh and blood. He's going to play that role forever. You will not be abandoned. You will not be forsaken. You will not be left as orphans, as he puts it. So that makes sense then why he would say another Parakletos. Here he is in their midst. He is the Parakletos, but he's about to go away. But he says, don't be dismayed, though. God is going to send you another Parakletos to take my place. Okay, well, in what sense, then, is he the Parakletos? I think the idea is, it's parallel to the way John starts his gospel. Jesus is the light of the world. Let's not go that far yet. I'll come back to that. He tells us what the Parakletos is. He says he's the Spirit of Truth. Not the Spirit of power, which is the way we have always tended to see the Spirit, as the power source, the one who takes the power of God and who brings it to us and imparts it to us. It's not that the Spirit cannot do that and does not ever do that. We can come back to that. That is a role that the Spirit can play, but that's not his primary function as Jesus is describing it here.
And here again is in John.
John chapter 14, yeah.
And what verse was that?
Verse 17.
Could you read that one more time? I think it's pretty important.
Okay, starting with 16. I will ask the Father, and he will give you another Parakletos, that he may be with you forever. That is, the Spirit of Truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it does not see him or know him. But you know him, because he abides with you and will be in you.
Okay, so it's very clear what this Parakletos is, what this Spirit is that will come after Jesus is the Spirit of Truth.
Exactly.
Not power.
Right.
But the Spirit of Truth.
Of truth. That then makes sense why he uses the word Parakletos, because truth is something you need to be persuaded of. So the point that he's making is, I am the Parakletos right now because I'm the one, speaking for Jesus, I'm the one that God sent into the world to take the truth of God and persuade you all of the truth of God. What does that involve?
So, would he be God's mouthpiece?
Exactly. God's spokesman, God's mouthpiece, God's revelation, or, as John puts it, the light of the world in John 1. That is, we were all in darkness, we were all clueless about who God really was, what he was up to in the world, what he was up to in history, who we were in relationship to God. We were basically foolish, clueless creatures.
Very little understanding, and so when Jesus came, he's clarifying.
Yeah, shed light on all those questions.
And he's saying, well, don't worry, because even when I'm gone, all of a sudden the shades aren't going to go down. The Spirit will be here, and it will shed light. It will give you understanding.
Right.
You're not going to be left alone here.
Exactly. So don't be dismayed that I have the answers to those important questions, and I am going away, but it doesn't mean you're going to be without answers. From now on, my Father is going to send another Parakletos who's going to be at work in the world to make my case for believing the truth, believing and grasping and understanding the truth. And he's going to continue to work within yourselves and in the world to compel you, persuade you that the gospel is true, that the truth is true. And so you won't be left alone.
So the Spirit's role is to share truth with us, which is synonymous with understanding. And eventually, even that we'll get wisdom.
Yeah.
We'll be wise people because we have this truth.
So in a word, the word I would use instead of power, it is enlightenment. The Spirit's primary role is to come into the world and enlighten us.
And enlighten means take us from darkness, which is our normal place, a lack of understanding, a lack of clarity. Give us really good glasses and a lot of light to see what we need to see.
Right. Exactly. Now, maybe we should stop and talk about that a little bit, because notice what he says here. He says the world cannot receive the Spirit of Truth, whom the world cannot receive. Why can the world cannot receive? The world's problem is not just ignorance. The darkness that we are all in before Jesus comes into the world, the darkness that we're in is not because no one has informed us before. The darkness that we're in is primarily a moral problem, moral and spiritual problem. We are creatures who by our very nature hate God and everything he stands for. I mean, even if we don't articulate it in those terms, we may be atheists who have convinced ourselves there is no God, and we would never think in terms of saying, I hate God, because that's not part of my worldview. But the reality, the resistance in me to truth, comes from and is rooted in my fundamental hatred of God. We even hate God enough to not even acknowledge that he exists at times. That's where the darkness comes from. So just bringing information to us isn't going to change that. Bringing information doesn't... If you bring me information when I'm in that state, I just reject the information. I just don't believe it. I'm resistant to it. I'm unpersuadable. I'm hardened against it. So the kind of enlightenment that the Spirit brings into our life and into the world has to involve a softening of the hearts of people that are hard. There's really no other way that a human being will receive the truth from God if there isn't this miraculous supernatural activity within me to turn my heart of stone into a heart of flesh, to turn my resistance to truth into receptivity to truth. So that's fundamentally the role of the Spirit in our lives. As the Spirit sanctifies us, at the most basic level, what the Spirit is doing is giving me a new heart, a heart that is receptive to truth rather than rebelling against it. So it's not merely an intellectual thing. In fact, it's not primarily an intellectual thing. It's not, he's not adding to my stock of data from which I form my beliefs. He's making me receptive to data that has been there all along and is already there, as well as bringing some new data. Jesus did bring some new data as well, but bringing the data, the new data alone, would not have been sufficient.
So it's a softening.
Right.
It's an opening of my heart toward what's true and what's good.
Teaching me to value what before I didn't value at all.
And having me like it and be drawn toward it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Enlightened in the sense that I want it, that it's appealing to me.
Yes. And so that, incidentally, is, I think, how we need to understand what he said leading into this section. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, otherwise believe because of the works themselves. Truly, truly, I say to you, now he's speaking to the 12 that have been chosen to be his apostles, which is to say, they have been chosen to be his flesh and blood spokesmen for him in the world. The job that they have been given is, you're going to go into the world and you're going to speak for me. People are going to want to know, how did Jesus answer the questions, the important questions of life? And you're going to give them my answers. That's the task. That's why they're feeling, potentially, that's what he's addressing is, you know, if you or I are sitting there and Jesus has been spent the last 2 or 3 years teaching us and he says, I'm going to leave, but people are going to want to know what life is all about. You tell them what I said. I would freak. Yeah. Wow. Well, wait.
We haven't had enough time
I didn't
yet.
Know there was going to be a final exam. Wait, can we do the course over again? Or, Jesus, do you have to go? I mean, why can't you be here to answer the questions?
Well, how about 50 more years?
Or 50, yeah. And that's why he's saying, don't be dismayed. I will send another Parakletos. You're not going to be left alone in your task of being spokesman for me. The Father is going to help you. He's going to send another Parakletos, as if I were by your side, in a sense. Another Parakletos who will help you in your task of representing me to the world. So that's who he's speaking to, these 12 people who have that very, very weighty responsibility. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, he who believes in me, the works that I do, he will do also, and greater works than these he will do, because I go to the Father. Okay, that's been very confusing to a lot of believers, because, boy, how do we do greater works than Jesus? Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. He walked on top of the Sea of Galilee. He turned water into wine.
He rose from the dead.
He rose from the dead, yeah. I mean, he did some pretty heavy stuff. Greater works we're going to do? No, that's not what he's talking about. It's true that the apostles did supernatural, miraculous things that were comparable to the things that Jesus did, apart from raising from the dead, discounting Jesus' resurrection. Every one of the miracles of Jesus was replicated by an apostle. I mean, every one of them was, in effect, virtually replicated by the apostles. So Jesus didn't have anything over the apostles in that respect. But that's not what he's saying. The greater works that he's talking about, I think, have to do with their work as advocates. Jesus came into the world to be an advocate for God, and he was a miserable failure in a certain way of looking at it. That is to say, it wasn't Jesus' earthly ministry that turned the world on its head. It didn't happen. What happened instead is the world responded to him with hostility in a kangaroo court, convicted him of a crime that wasn't even a crime, hung him on the cross, killed him. He was not a successful parakletos for God, nor was he supposed to be. It wasn't in God's scheme of things that he be a successful parakletos. And that's what you see in the book of Acts, is where the success began to happen, started with the day of Pentecost. What happened when Peter spoke up...
I'm a little uncomfortable with this.
Okay.
I think you're saying it too black and white.
Okay.
In a sense, Jesus was very much a success. He wouldn't have had 12 people that really got it. So there were pockets of people, certainly most identifiable as the 12. So he was quite successful in that way, but it wasn't the kind of success that we think of, wow, there was a sweep through the culture and people's eyes were open, that we see in Acts.
Exactly.
But even though it wasn't apparently successful, there was a lot of success in a very kind of quiet way.
Right.
That was much noisier after his death and resurrection. That's recorded in Acts.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, he was right on schedule. He was doing the will of God. He was doing exactly what God intended to work in the world and was incredibly successful at that. But in a certain way of measuring success, that noise level, his success was very quiet. The apostles got much noisier, and that's a good way of putting it. It's like the parable that he taught. The kingdom of God is like the mustard seed, that even though it's the smallest of all the seeds in the garden, it grows into this bush so big that the birds can nest in the branches. Jesus was on the early end of that mustard seed growing, and the apostles begin the very dramatic
noise making.
Yeah, okay, the noise making later, the bigger branches later. That's the sense in which I think Jesus is meaning that when he says, greater works than these he will do, namely you apostles will do, because I go to the Father. See, the point that he's making is God is about to begin making some noise in the world. But what's going to be required before he can begin making some noise in the world is I'm going to leave. I've got to go. There's another part of the role that God has for me that requires my death, my resurrection, and my ascension, and that I split here. And you're the ones that are going to be around when God starts being noisier about what he's doing in the world. So there's a sense in which we can say, you guys are going to do greater things than I did. You guys in your fleshly, physical existence are going to be a bigger deal than I was. Now, granted, if there wasn't the foundation laid by Jesus, they couldn't have done that. But
because his was the story that they told.
Exactly.
He had to die and be resurrected to really have anything great to say.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able to report on something incredible, and the Spirit really moved through that story.
Right. But it's very striking when you look at the day of Pentecost, and Peter preaches a sermon, and Luke tells us that 5,000 people believed on that day. How very different that is than, say, the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus lays it all out, you know, what real righteousness, what real love of God would look like. And what's the ultimate result of that? Could you multiply some more bread and fishes? I mean, I'm getting events mixed up there, but the spirit of their response was, I mean, I like the Monty Python. There was a line in the Monty Python, A Life of Brian, where it portrays Jesus saying, blessed are the peacemakers, and somebody in the crowd turns to the other person and says, blessed are the cheesemakers? I mean, that just this kind of, it just captures what I think was really the case, this kind of dense dullness, inability to really get it. Yeah, just this cluelessness.
This is just washing off our backs.
Right. And why was that? Because the Spirit had not been poured out upon the crowd that Jesus was talking to. The Spirit had been poured out onto the crowd that Peter was talking to. And that made all the difference in the world.
So you don't see people enlightened
exactly.
very much.
You don't
Jesus
see the
talks.
Lights going on with Jesus' teaching.
But at Pentecost, there were so many lights that there was just, it was stunning.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's what I think Jesus means. Jesus knows that God is about to enter into a whole new stage of history where he's going to pour out his spirit. And when he pours out his spirit, this other parakletos that he's going to send, lights are going to go on in people's lives in a way that the Father was not making happen during Jesus' earthly ministry. Jesus knows that, and he predicts it. And he says, when I go, the other parakletos is going to come, and boy, are you going to see some interesting fireworks then. Lights are going to go on in people's lives, and people are going to believe who have been clueless up till this point in history. So that's the primary understanding in the Gospels and in Acts of what the effect of the Spirit coming into the world is. He's the Spirit of truth, the Spirit that brings an enlightenment as to what the truth is.
Okay, and we really need to look at that closely, because there is a different kind of enlightenment that happened during Pentecost and, you know, the first several chapters of Acts than is happening today. In a sense, it feels like to me, Jack, that we're generally pretty dim again.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It looks almost as though the Spirit of God has become very quiet again. There's not much noise going on. Now, I do recognize it in the hearts of individuals, and certainly I know it in my heart. There's a Spirit alive and well and teaching me and enlightening me, and I see that in many others. But in terms of the big hoopla that happened in Pentecost, it just isn't there.
Right, right. Yeah, we might need to come back to this, but I think it's crucial to understand. So often people look at that day of Pentecost as if the Spirit of God has never been active in the world until that day. That what's being described as the entrance stage right of the Spirit into world history for the very first time has never appeared on the stage of history before. This is his first appearance. I don't think that's what they're saying. Because if I'm right, that no human being can ever be enlightened without the activity of the Spirit of God, then how do we explain Abraham? How do we explain Moses? How do we explain David?
But it's confusing, Jack, because Jesus said in the future, don't be dismayed, disciples, because in the future, when I'm gone, the Spirit will come, which seems to be saying the Spirit isn't here yet.
It seems to, exactly, and that's my point, is does he mean the Spirit is going to come in the sense that there has been no activity of the Spirit of God in anybody's life before, ever before? Or does he mean that the Spirit is going to work in the world on a scope that is unprecedented, on a scale, if you will? Scope is a better word, because it's not as if the Spirit has not opened the eyes of individuals throughout past history. But at the day of Pentecost, what seems to happen is we have this widespread receptivity to the truth that has never, ever before existed in human history. And that was what was really striking to me. As you go through the Old Testament, you don't ever see a period of time in the whole Old Testament where you have large-scale belief. You have individuals who kind of rise above the masses and stand out for their outstanding belief. But you don't have anything that ever portrays a whole generation that is largely open to the things of God, responsive to the things of God. In fact, on the contrary, you get these individuals speaking, prophets, for example, speaking to the nation and speaking for God, saying, you stiff-necked people who will not follow me and will not obey me. You have a long history of the very people of God, the chosen people of God, generation after generation after generation, having prophets plead with them to repent and believe and refusing to do so. That's the picture we have. That never changes throughout all of biblical history until you get to Pentecost. And then somehow after Pentecost, you have Paul later go into a town and speak in a synagogue and have half the people interested. I was just reading a passage in Acts the other day where it basically speaks as if the town itself is split down the middle. Some sided with the apostles and some sided with those people who are opposing the gospel. Well, boy, we could wish. I mean, 50% ain't bad when you're talking about the gospel. Not that 50% of the town became believers. I'm not arguing that. But 50% were at least open enough to the truth that they would hear him out. And were intrigued by it, and were fascinated by it, and were attracted to it initially, even if it didn't stick, even if it didn't last. Well, where in the Old Testament do you see that kind of responsiveness to any prophet? Never. They killed them all. Or shined them on, ignored them.
So what you're saying is the Spirit wasn't new. There was only this kind of new kind of ministry it had to really open a lot of people's eyes where he hadn't done it before and really hasn't done it since in that big, huge way.
Yeah, maybe in the future we need to talk about this sort of, but I need to qualify that. So, you know, maybe in a future program we can take that up.
Okay.
I think the operative pouring out the Spirit is intended to be a metaphor for abundance. As opposed to dropping the Spirit, you know, in droplets throughout human history, now he just takes the bucket and he just dumps it. He dumps the whole bucket down into. I think that's the metaphor that he's going for. Pouring out is describing this generosity, this liberality of
this abundance
of his activity. Yeah.
So let me try and review what we've said so far. We have a minute left. We started by saying, what is the Spirit not? And it's not power for us to do something especially miraculous. It isn't a power switch that we have to turn on doing something particularly great and then turn it off. It doesn't have to do with a power switch or with power at all.
Mm-hmm.
The Spirit also is not, generally speaking, a comforter in the sense that the Spirit makes us feel good, comes along and is an emotional support to us. Not that either. And so the question was, what is the Spirit? Because that's what we've kind of always thought is the Spirit. Oh, and we also said before that, we said that the Spirit also isn't something that comes and makes us godly people. Gives us a victorious Christian life where we don't err, where we leave sin behind. So again, if it's not those things, then what is it? And what you were making an argument for was the Spirit of God is one that comes to enlighten us. Not necessarily just to give us information, because the information has pretty much always been available. But it is to open our darkened hearts to light. To throw open the sashes and let that light come in and help us to see where we didn't see before. Help us to gain an understanding where we might have had the information right in front of us, but not gotten it. And now we're able to get it. Now we're able to understand. Now we're able to see truth. Now we're people who are becoming wise through that working of the Spirit in our lives.
Exactly.
At the end of this century, the big questions about reality and being human rise with unexpected power. We ask, ever more agonizingly, what does it mean to be human? How do human beings fit into this vast cosmos? Where to from here? In his News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality, Mackenzie Study Center member Wes Hurd shows how our present-day culture answers these questions in radically non-biblical ways. He shows how the prevalent postmodern view of life is fed to us through television, popular music, and education. However, he also states that although postmodernism has many negative aspects, it may present opportunities for biblical Christians to dialogue more openly with people who need real answers to some big questions. Call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality.
It's been about 3 years ago now that the director of this program approached me and said, hey, Christine, would you like to spend some time talking on the air on a radio program with Jack Crabtree? And, you know, immediately I thought, oh, I'd really love to do that. And immediately I thought, oh, man, I'm really intimidated by that, totally intimidated. And as you know, it took us about, oh, gosh, I think 3 months for us just to kind of do practice stuff, for me to even stop being so nervous that I could talk, and for us to kind of figure out really what we wanted this format to be.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Yeah, I do. Seems not that long ago.
And no, it really doesn't seem like that long ago. And we went through different formats, and we finally came up with this conversational style that's very extemporaneous between you and I.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, but now we're coming to the end of the time of the radio program. In fact, when is our last one going to air?
The last weekend of March, and some radio stations maybe April, but that last weekend in March.
You know, Jack, as our time is coming to an end, I just really want to thank you for the honor of having the opportunity to sit in this room and talk to you for a couple of hours every week. I couldn't have chosen anything better to do. It was such a gift to me.
Oh, thank you. I mean, you're way too kind. I have very much appreciated your patience in listening to me and trying to translate me and make me understandable, because I realize that I can go off into Never Never Land. And I think you have done a wonderful job of bringing us back down to earth and making sure we stay focused on the issues that really ultimately matter, which is what all this stuff is about. I mean, this is not about being smart. It's not about being educated. It's not about knowing a lot, I should say. It's not about impressing people with our Bible knowledge or theology. Ultimately, the end, none of it matters if it doesn't penetrate our lives and change the way we look at our circumstances, we look at our existence, and learn to love God out of it. So I think you have done a tremendous job of bringing the focus back to where it needs to be, and I appreciate that. Thanks.
Thank you. I think that we have ended up being real teachers for each other.
Yeah.
And a real good team in terms of learning how to communicate what our hearts beat about.
Yeah.
And sharing that with the people that hear this radio program. And it's heard in about 6 different stations throughout the country. And I think it's a real privilege to have been able to share with all you people. So thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.